Good afternoon, everyone, members and observers of the Standing Advisory Group. Also welcome to members of the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board and also others observing our meeting here in person and also on the webcast. As I'm sure you know, Tom Ray, the PCOB Chief Auditor, typically chairs the meetings of the Standing Advisory Group. Unfortunately for this meeting, Tom is unable to be here. However, he has asked Greg Skates and I to chair this meeting on his behalf, and we are happy to do so. We have several topics on the agenda this afternoon and also tomorrow, which we are interested in obtaining your feedback. Today, we'll discuss two topics, the first being audit considerations in the current economic environment, and the second is feasibility of audit indicators, audit quality indicators.
Ask for a point of personal privilege. Okay. I'm sorry, but this is Steve Harris. It's our first meeting to the SAG, and he's heard a lot about it from the time he got here. Steve is a new board member. Took the seat that Kayla Gillen had. Steve and I have known each other for a long time, and we've had the opportunity to work together when we were both in the working for the Senate Banking Committee, Steve on one side of the aisle and I on the other. And Steve already has shown us that he's going to make a very important contribution to the SAG. So, Steve, welcome him.
No problem. I guess I'm not doing a good job so far in my first 5 minutes. I don't know. Thank you. As I was saying, today we will talk about two topics, and tomorrow we have three. We'll continue our discussion on audit quality indicators. We'll talk about the signing of the auditor's report, and then we'll conclude our meeting tomorrow with a discussion on our proposed standard-setting activities. Before we get into the agenda topics, there is a housekeeping item which I need to remind everyone of, and those relate to the club's rules, the rules of the Army-Navy Club. Here, they ask that all of us respect two of those rules. One is that men, and this applies to men and not women, but men, if you leave this room and go into the common areas, that you have your jackets on. And the second applies to everyone is they do not want us to use cell phones in this building. So you must leave the building if you need to use your phone, make a phone call. So I request that you respect the rules of the Army-Navy Club in that regard. I'd like to move on to our emerging issue discussion. Obviously, there's much in the press and there's much happening every day with respect to the current economic environment. Many of our focus has been on what's happening with us personally and our own personal accounts, but in our view at the PCOB, our mission is regards to the auditors. And so we've been giving some thought and are interested today in feedback from the members of the Standing Advisory Group on how this economic environment affects auditors and also has an impact, or what impact does it have in connection with upcoming audits of public companies. I've asked Marty Baumann to join me in this discussion today. Marty Baumann, as I think all of you know, is the PCOB Director of Research and Analysis. Marty leads that group, and his group is focused on risk, and his group provides feedback to all areas of the PCOB, including inspections, standards, as well as others. I've asked Marty to share, because of his focus on risk and the economic environment, asked him to share his views on how risk may impact auditors in the upcoming audits to help tee up this discussion. So, Marty.
Thank you, Jennifer, for that introduction. And good afternoon, everybody. I speak to auditors in a variety of forums, and certainly for the past, going well into 2007 and certainly all of 2008, in any speech before any audit group, have told them that I think they're dealing in one of the most challenging audit environments that I can remember. And I had been an auditor for 33 years before my most recent job. So this is an extraordinarily difficult time, I think, for many people, for the economy, for preparers of financial statements, but certainly for auditors. So today we wanted to talk to the Standing Advisory Group about the current economic crisis. And we're going to talk, quite frankly, very little, because we want your input. And after I talk for just a few moments, we'll put up a few questions. But really, the big question would be, what do you think we ought to be doing in terms of giving guidance, if anything, to auditors in this environment? Well over a year ago, I sat here at the table and talked about the subprime mortgage crisis and the developments for financial institutions and problems they were seeing in subprime. And we talked a little bit about how that might emerge into something broader at this table, some of you may recall. In December of 2007, PCAOB issued practice alert number 2, dealing with the auditing of fair value measurements and the use of specialists. And practice alert 2 didn't issue new audit guidance, but it reminded auditors of their responsibilities regarding fair value measurements and pointed out certain key, pulled together all of the auditing standards into one cohesive place and linked them together with some of the with the accounting guidance. And one important point it made was if auditors were getting quotes from brokers or pricing services and they were neither a bid to purchase securities nor based on active trades, but instead the broker or pricing service model, that we thought auditors under existing rules needed to understand the inputs to those models. And things like that, I think, have been an important matter for auditors as they've struggled through the auditing of fair value. It's been a difficult time in 07 and into 08. But as it's not hard to observe that there continue to be challenges in financial institutions. Obviously, with measuring fair value, the SEC and the FASB came out with a joint press release recently. The FASB came out with an FSP amending FAS 157 by putting in an example with respect to measuring fair value in illiquid markets. That fair value itself continues to be a challenge. But other areas within financial institutions certainly have raised their head recently, including credit default swaps and derivatives. Certainly the allowance for loan losses in financial institutions would be a complex area. Can you forward that slide, Jennifer? So another subject is other than temporary impairment. Other than temporary impairment is interesting. It's one of the most principles-based of the accounting standards that we have, and certainly it's one that's being debated quite a lot today by both preparers, auditors, and regulators in terms of how to interpret other than temporary impairment in today's times. There certainly are a lot of securities that are underwater for an extended period of time, and interpreting the principles-based guidance around that has been a challenge for both preparers and auditors. But beyond financial institutions, and this is a little bit about what we want to talk about today or hear from you, there are issues that are the fallout from the credit crisis. Questions emerge as to responsibilities of auditors to express a going concern opinion if it appears that the company is experiencing difficulties and may not be able to operate for the next cycle, usually considered to be 1 year in terms of the existing auditing standards. It's worth pointing out that the FASB has recently issued proposed guidance for preparers regarding going concern considerations. Going concern has traditionally been an area only in the auditing literature and not part of generally accepted accounting principles. Other areas that you might consider with respect to audit challenges, and you get beyond the fact that this was initially a subprime crisis and then it's extended into collateralized debt obligations and probably many of the securities and assets on the banks and financial institutions' balance sheets, but the impact is now certainly gone. The fallout is into other industries. Whether or not we're in a recession is not a debate for this group, but many say that retailers could have a sluggish season in 2008 and a variety of industries in manufacturing are reporting difficulties as well. If that's the case, going concern might be a bigger challenge for auditors at the end of 08 than it even was in 07. And then other areas such as the ones listed here, pensions. S&P 500 companies overall were overfunded maybe a year ago, but as I read, are now overall underfunded in their pension plans. Pension plans have important considerations that have to be taken into account, such as discount rate and expected return on plan assets, and expected returns could be a challenging assumption for both preparers and auditors in the context of the preparation of the current year's financial statements. Receivables of all types, whether it's a retailer's receivable or in manufacturing, we've observed some statistics in a variety of places and industries which have indicated days sales outstanding growing as well. So an increasing audit risk around receivables. Inventories, whether the retailers or manufacturers, have to be carried at lower of cost or market, and fair value, of course, being determined these days under FAS 157. But again, with potentially shelves with more inventory than expected and sales less than expected, reporting inventories at lower of cost or market could be challenging areas. Other areas of asset impairments include other variety of long-lived assets, including goodwill. With acquisitions that have been done in the past years, one just has to look at the stock prices today and indicate that values certainly have decreased, and might wonder whether expectations as to the realizability of what the cash flows were at the time of purchase are the same as those might be in today's environment. And so taking a look at goodwill, other amortizable intangibles, and other long-lived assets could present challenging areas. Deferred taxes, an environment in which companies are reporting losses exposed to future losses may indicate a need for a valuation reserve for deferred taxes under Statement 109, which indicates that a valuation allowance should be sufficient to reduce the deferred tax asset to an amount that is more likely than not to be realized. So really, just I sort of talked down the left-hand side of the balance sheet and said, maybe not just for financial institutions, but for industries in general, there could be a variety of issues with respect to the left-hand side of the balance sheet and valuations. And then, of course, there's importance of disclosures. There's many we could have talked about, but let's just take SOP 94.6, for example, disclosure of certain risks and uncertainties. This is maybe a period of time where disclosures of risks and uncertainties might be very, very important for a variety of companies to put in their financial statements, and auditors may feel like those would be essential items. So at this point in time, really what we want to do, Jennifer, is I think tee up a couple of questions, I think, on the next slide. Mm-hmm. And I guess the first set of questions we have is, do these areas present specific challenges in the current economic environment, and do you believe there are any additional areas relevant to consider? And what are the areas identified are most likely to be significant? So that's the first question we'd like to open with to the group and get your input on these other audit risks that you might see emerging as part of this current economic crisis. Thank you.
Galen Hansen.
Thank you, Marty, and I really do want to thank the staff of the PCOB, and on behalf of all the SAG members, I'm sure we would say the same thing to Tom. We're going to miss him here today. Marty, I do remember a year ago when we talked about the subprime, and it was a big deal, and I remember that alert that came out. Even prior to that, the Center for Audit Quality issued an alert 207-51, a white paper on measurements of fair value in illiquid markets. And I, going back into what they said, and if I might just quote very briefly, it is not unreasonable to expect, especially for subprime mortgage-related assets, that current conditions could persist for an extended period of time until uncertainty reduced when it will become clear that defaults have peaked and real estate prices have bottomed out. Well, that was a year ago, and yet even today I'm seeing that a major bank has recorded a $19 billion goodwill write-down. And from what I've been reading, we're seeing banks that their trading prices are significantly less than what their book values are. So the question is begged, you know, how much more is there out there, and what does this mean for auditors, which I think is what our question is. And I think, you know, in my mind, the question has to be raised, where were the auditors, and why weren't there some early warnings on this? What about SOP 94-6? And why isn't 94-6? Why does that seem to be such a difficult thing to be able to put it on the table and alert the public as to what has been happening? I would hope that would be part of our discussion today. It seems to me that there should have been some indication as to what was out there and whether or not these companies could weather the storm. And perhaps 94-6, and that's an accounting question, needs to be expanded, but are the auditors doing what they need to do to make sure that that's being followed by the companies? Thank you.
Thank you, Galen. Joe Carcello.
Thank you, Jennifer. Let me try to directly respond to the questions here. In terms of areas that present specific audit challenges in the current environment, when I read the briefing paper before I got too far into it, I thought I didn't want to be biased, so I wrote down areas that I thought would be potentially problematic, and I think the list, Marty, I guess your group has developed, is pretty good. Had most of the things I had thought of. I'll throw a few others out there for you to think about. On the financial statement side, I think one thing you might want to consider is contingencies. There's going to be a lot of lawsuits, and there's also some guarantees that are out there that are potentially problematic. I guess it's FIN 45, so you probably want to think about that. You might want to think about FIN 46R, because some of these vehicles that have been set up to house this paper have been set up off the balance sheet and are being pulled back onto the balance sheet, and so you might want to think about issues surrounding that. And then FAS 123R on stock-based compensation, probably the most important determinant of the value of the option is the volatility. What do you use as a volatility measure now? And that's going to be, I think, a challenge. I don't have the answer, but I think it's going to be a challenge. Then everything you had up there, Marty, strikes me as financial statement focused, which is certainly appropriate. But I also thought about internal control over financial reporting. So I had a couple of thoughts as it relates to that. One would be disclosure failures in the MD&A, other parts of the 10K, and the proxy, to the extent that they exist. What does this tell you about the control environment, information and communication, and monitoring? So although the auditor is not necessarily auditing those things, the auditor is at least reading the 10K, and to the extent there are issues there, I think that's a signal about certain aspects of the control environment, which the auditor is auditing as part of ICFR. The other thing is, do financial institutions have a material weakness in internal control due to problems with the risk assessment component of internal control? A lot of people would say, as it relates to risk assessment, a number of the financial institutions have clearly failed. So what does that tell us, if anything, about internal control? So at least those are things to think about.
Yeah, those are all good things, and thank you for that contribution, Joe.
Greg Jonas.
Thanks, Jennifer. Comments on one of the items, Marty, that you mentioned, and then let me add five to the list. First comment on the list, it strikes me as a very reasonable list. Regarding going concern, you know, I don't think we're very good as auditors of flagging going concerns. I think when an auditor says there's substantial doubt about a going continuing as a going concern. What the auditor means is it's almost certain that the company is going to go bankrupt. If you look at companies that have gone bankrupt and ask what percentage of the time does the auditor flag going concern in the year prior to that, you find out our track record's about 50 cents on the dollar, if I remember the academic research. So we're not all that good at this, and of course we're going into a period of time when there's going to be many companies, unfortunately, that face this prospect. So perhaps some guidance to auditors about looking at outside signals about going concerns, market prices, credit default swap prices, for example. There are some indicators that auditors could look to that might help. I think the biggest problem, though, we have with going concern is that the market has come to be trained to think that going concern means for sure that it's going to go down, and so there's a real bias on the auditor to not pull that trigger unless they're absolutely certain, because companies tell them, my God, if you say this, it's going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy because of the way the market interprets it. So I think we have a problem in the way we apply going concern, and at the same time, I think it's an important thing to signal when there's a pending problem, and we should pull the trigger more often than we do. Very quickly, the five things that I would add is, number one, I think in this environment there is a heightened risk of senior management cooking the books. You know, the fraud risk triangle has got, opportunity, pressure, and integrity, and of course the pressure is going to be enormous on people. We're talking about careers and families, and it's tough, and the temptation is growing, and I think we need to be ever vigilant about that. My second addition relates to revenue recognition. In my experience, when things get tight, companies still want to do business, customers still want to buy, but the customer may not be able to pay in cold hard cash as they had done before, and so the two parties get creative, and I don't mean that in a negative sense, but economically they get creative as to how to do business but not transact in cash. And whenever that happens, it can raise complex issues. And, you know, we just need to keep our mind on what the rules are. And the rules are complex, but oftentimes don't allow revenue recognition for all or part of the transaction when the parties get creative about how to do business even when cash is tight. My third addition relates to contractual triggers littered throughout contracts, obviously, including debt agreements. There are often triggers based on market prices or credit ratings or any myriad of things, and it's always amazing that, you know, what's in the small print of these contracts, and it's not until times get tough that these things go off like little bombs, and it kind of surprises people. So it might be a good time to read the details of these contracts and really try to flag what are the relevant triggers. The next one on my list is restructuring. I think there's going to be a lot of that, and I think I know as users, I think many of us users are confused about how companies report restructurings these days. My sense is that some accountants and auditors are also need to be reminded about what those rules are, and because there's going to be a lot of it going on, and we need to be good at reporting restructurings. Do so under the rules. And then finally, my final item, and then I promise to be quiet here, is liquidity. I recognize that there is not a footnote in the financials on liquidity, although some of them bang up against this, but there certainly is a lot of this in MD&A, and I know auditors aren't auditing MD&A, but we need to read the disclosures and make sure they're consistent with our understanding. And, you know, liquidity is just an enormous issue these days for companies. And so spending time thinking hard and long about, you know, the SEC has excellent guidance, I think, now in their MD&A rules about liquidity. And it's really important that companies and auditors can help companies get the complete story out on the table. Thank you.
Greg, thanks for the list. I just wanted to check something with you. And when you commented on restructurings, were you including a risk of a potential big bath type write-offs given the fact that losses are expected anyway?
Yeah. Under the restructuring rules, of course, Marty, there's less opportunity to take a big bath through restructuring. You kind of got to wait these days until things occur. But certainly, you know, the big bath risk is a risk. That isn't the one that I had in mind, though, but now that you mention it, it's certainly a risk.
I was linking it into your earlier comment on financial fraud. So.
Thank you. Vin Coleman.
I think the list is pretty good. You know, in our firm, we try to go through and the additions. You know, we've been messaging a lot of these areas. But the one area that we've messaged pretty heavily that's not included here is more from a governance standpoint. So what should the communications to the audit committee be? And to go through the various risks and understanding. So to Greg's point that he just made, talk about the liquidity and maybe communications with the rating agencies as an example, and the sensitivity of the rating agencies, whether it's in the audit committee or the finance committee, or that type of oversight and communication that everybody really understands the risk assessment, the changes in the risk assessment being communicated based on current events, because it's been very, very fluid. So if you were to give an audit committee an audit plan back in the spring, I would assert to you that there's been quite a few changes, you know, perhaps as you're going into, you know, your year-end phase. And that seems to be, this seems to be much more accounting-driven, which is fair, but I think there should be some governance drive, too, in your consideration.
Thanks, Ben. Joe, did you have your card up again, or is that from before? Okay, go ahead.
I just wanted to add something to what Greg said. I thought what Greg said was very good, but I wanted to maybe just clarify one thing, because he did refer to the academic literature, and he pointed out that, I think he said 50% on the dollar, that auditors only issue a going concern about half the time before a company goes bankrupt within the next year, and that's not so good. One, if you become interested in this topic and you want to actually look at something that might be helpful, there's a pretty seminal paper in the late 90s, I believe it was 1998, published in the Journal of Accounting Research by Jane Mutchler, Jim McCune, and Anthony Hopwood. And they basically, the argument has been made that models out-predict auditors in predicting going concern. And so they make the argument, if that's true, then auditors would be pretty irrational not to use those models. And so that doesn't seem very likely, given the economic incentives that auditors have to get it right. And so they make a number of essentially technical and econometric adjustments and relook at the question. And what they find is that the auditor is as good, if not better, than any model in predicting going concern. So I don't disagree with what you've said, Greg, but it's just really hard to do well. And it's not obvious that we have a mechanical model that can do better. And if anything, the evidence seems to suggest that the auditors are probably better than the models we have right now.
Thanks, Joe. Bob Tirola.
Thanks, Jennifer. I think the list is fine, and especially as supplemented by those who have spoken before me. What I'd like to suggest is, though, that the auditing profession take a leadership role in communicating the risks that they will be focusing on over the next cycle, as opposed to let companies maybe haphazardly deal with them on their own. I think the auditing profession is condensed relative to public companies in a relatively I think focused way. Information can get out into the marketplace as to what risks will be addressed, what would be expected of preparers, so that there's a clear expectation within the marketplace and among companies and auditors of how the current economic situation will be dealt with in financial reporting.
Thanks, Bob. Well, I guess, Bob, in your to kind of respond to your remark or comment on it, you suggested the auditing profession provide some type of guidance. Our next question up here is a question related to, should the PCAOB issue additional guidance? So in connection with your comment, you know, would like feedback, in that point, should it be the auditing profession? Would it be helpful for the PCAOB to issue additional guidance to all auditors? So, just keep that in mind as well. Lynn Turner?
To your last question there, I do think someone needs to put out something. The AICPA has done a good job in the past of putting out their annual audit risk alerts, and I think something coming out of the board or the staff of the board in that regards would be most helpful, focusing on the things that you and others have already laid out. So I think putting that out in black and white, because I think that also helps companies, because if you put it out and companies are aware that it's out there, then they know the things to focus on. They can focus on them at the same time the auditors are. And I think that'll help out everyone sitting around the table in those conversations then. So I'd certainly encourage the board to turn around and consider putting out some guidance on the issues that you've talked about. Having gone through these type of situations before, though, I think there's some overarching things that you need to think about as you put out that guidance. I think Marty mentioned the issues with pensions and inventory, and Joe mentioned the issues with 123 and the valuation. In general, when we have a recession like we're heading into, people have a very difficult time making that adjustment. They tend to look at the historical trends up to where we're at and forget that we're going through a major shift and fundamental shift, and what's been there in the past is no longer what's going to be there in the future going forward. So I think you need to emphasize that they almost have to throw out historical trends here and start looking at what's really happening on a real active real-time basis. Because one of the biggest impacts is we're already seeing companies' revenues are going to slow down significantly, companies' cash flows are going to slow down, and the profits are going to decline significantly from where they've been in the past as spending comes to a halt. And that means, the goodwill stuff, as you mentioned, is back on the table, the value of the assets, the inventory, whether or not you get collectability on the receivables. If you reserve 2% in the past, that's not necessarily going to work anymore going forward. And so people really need to be thinking about what's changing here on a quarter-by-quarter basis. This can't be something that you just audit at the end of the year either. You've got to really be looking at this throughout the year, both companies and the auditors. I've recently gone through some filings, and it's just amazing to see differences in what's going on with the reserves and all, through the first three quarters of the year, and then you get down to that fourth year quarter again. And thank God for the auditors in the fourth quarter, we probably wouldn't have even gotten that. But I do think some of that needs to be advised. The other thing is, we get into this, someone mentioned our responsibility as auditors to read the entire document. And this really ties into what the SEC does with MD&A and the importance of that piece of it. And we're going to have, again, some fundamental resets here, and there needs to be, the auditor needs to read that, and they need to read it with some integrity, and if they don't believe what's in there, then they need to do something about it. Too often we've seen auditors read MD&A. While they aren't auditing it, they almost are willing to give it a pass because their name isn't going on it. But that's not what SAS 8 says. SAS 8 says if you read it and you see something that's not correct in there, then you need to first of all go tell the audit committee about it, that it needs to change. And I think there needs to be some impetus on this, and back to the role of the auditor communicating with the audit committee. If they see something in there that they don't like, they can't just sit on it. They got to turn around and actually do something with it. Someone else mentioned the internal control area as well. I'm amazed that to date we've seen almost no weaknesses on internal controls and credit derivatives, despite the problem that they've created and the inability of people even to get good disclosures. We're seeing scenarios, we've certainly seen one that's been in the press a tad bit lately, where literally just a phenomenal impact, and yet if you go through those filings, you can't pull that impact out at all in a SOP 94-6. So either SOP 94-6 isn't working, or the companies aren't getting the disclosures and auditors are giving them a pass. But we are not getting, despite all this reports that we got a calamity on our hands. We're not getting anything out of these companies in the footnotes saying we got a calamity on your hands, right up to the point of where within a month or two they got to go borrow over $100 billion from the government. No indication that that is just around the corner. And it really begs the question is, if the auditors are on top of it and all, why isn't that getting into the disclosures under SAS 8 or otherwise? So I turn around and say, your list is pretty good, but there's some of those other things that you need to keep in mind as well.
One of our questions relates to, we had 10 things on our list, I think that was a count, and I'm hearing almost about 10 more. And thinking about whether or not we should issue guidance or what areas, are there any areas, that, our second question up here is, are most, you know, likely to be most significant? And maybe the answer is it depends, but kind of based on the list of things that we had on there plus other things that people have mentioned, or you know, interested in feedback or thoughts about any in particular that are more significant than others. Barbara Broker?
My comment is slightly sort of higher level since I don't know the details the way the rest of you do, but one of the things that concerns me most about the situation we find ourselves in is that we are entering this period of intense pressure after we have spent several years beating up on auditors for doing too much on internal controls and beating up on the PCAOB for doing too much on the standards for auditing internal controls, where the entire message has been we need to back down and back off. We're seeing the same kind of political pressure being brought to bear on fair value accounting. And I would just say that it is extraordinarily important if the auditors are going to be in the position of having to draw a tough line on some of these issues with their clients, that they have the backing of the board in the tone that it takes in talking about these issues, and that we don't send a subtle message or not so subtle message that auditors need to ease off and be a little more flexible and help everybody get through it, because that kind of message, which we've heard a lot of in recent years, I think is going to really undermine the ability for auditors to play the role they need to do in this environment.
Thanks, Barbara. Chuck Noski.
Noski, thank you. I find myself in the awkward position of agreeing with Lynn Turner, which is not frequent. But one of the things that I've heard a number of comments about what audit committees do or don't do around this issue, and I serve on and chair two audit committees. And one thing I know that management and audit committees are spending a lot of time on during in trying to address the difficulties in this current economic environment is within the context of the enterprise risk management frameworks. And companies spend an awful lot of time on it. I've been struck by how little time or attention is given by the independent auditors to the company's efforts in those areas. And of course, it's more than just financial reporting. It's operational, it's strategic, it's legal and compliance. But as you think about the kinds of disclosures that should either be in the MD&A or in the financial statements with respect to risk, auditors may want to think about taking a look at what managements are discussing and thinking about and responding to in their enterprise risk management framework. For example, in the companies I'm involved in, they're looking pretty holistically at the impact of the credit crisis, not only all of the things on your list, which I'll characterize as sort of balance sheet oriented, receivables, inventories, pension liabilities, and the like. They're also looking at the second order impacts of the credit crisis, things that might affect their vendors or suppliers or participants in their distribution channel. For example, if there are distributors between the company and the end customer, if those distributors have financial problems or access to credit problems, that's not going to necessarily show up in your financial statements, but the ability to continue to operate your business and generate revenues at the levels that you have historically generated at will be impaired. And that perhaps would be one example. So these second-order issues, if you're an oil and gas company, for example, and you're building a large capital project, They have typically viewed these projects that even if the operator goes into bankruptcy, for example, steel companies and things like that, they'll continue to operate. Well, if the project doesn't get finished because your partner has credit access problems, either you, the company, are going to put more money in, or you're going to have a dead asset sitting there, and then you're going to face an devaluation and other kinds of risks. And so I would just encourage you, as you think about the type of guidance that you provide to auditors, that they perhaps want to get a bit more involved in understanding what companies are doing in the ERM area and what the implications are to disclosures, and then to think about the second and third order impacts that may not be quite so apparent as the ones on your list. Thank you.
Thank you. Richard Dietrich.
Thank you. I'm going to take my position that I often do of being a contrarian, but this time I'm not sure who I'm opposed to, but so maybe it's the board. I want to begin by reinforcing, I hope, what Barbara Roper said a minute ago, and that is my interpretation of what's happening here overall is that this is another failure of financial reporting in the following way. People don't trust the financial statements. I received recently a set of data that showed market-to-book ratios for a variety of banks in the United States. And the ratio that I found to be most interesting was 0.08. That is, the market price of one bank was 8% of the book value of that bank's, according to its financial statements. What does that tell me, either about how people are pricing things right now in the marketplace or what the financial information in the balance sheet's really telling us? And so I think we have to be very concerned about what's really going on right now and our financial statements reflecting. It's consistent with this story about why people don't trade with each other. They don't trust the information. Catherine Schipper recently had a very eloquent statement on the importance of information for creating markets that function well. And when those when that information breaks down, the markets break down. And so to an extent that we've seen several trillion dollars wiped off the books recently, we really should be asking ourselves to what extent are those who are responsible for preparing information under which markets work effectively challenging those who set about doing that. So the question about whether we're over-auditing, the question about fair value measures are important questions to ask. But somebody has to stand up and say that we're losing a couple trillion dollars in value here if we don't get it right. So to that extent, one of the other things that I want to mention is, first, to whom are you addressing this potential statement? Your question says to assist auditors in their upcoming audits. Well, it seems to me that those should be the last people who need this assistance in the following way. The rest of this session is going to be talking about audit quality. If we have quality auditors, then the auditors already should do this. Ben Coleman alluded to that in his statements when said basically that they've already been messaging to their people virtually everything, if not more, than is in this statement. So a quality auditing firm is not going to learn much from this. Their clients might, and other investors might. So what you might think about in preparing this statement is, who really is the audience for this? You can say it's for the auditors, but if it really is for the auditors, we have a much more important problem, because the auditors should be thinking of these issues every year if they're going to do high-quality audits. And in fact, they should be thinking more in a contextual way for specific clients beyond anything you can put in the letter, unless you're going to put in everything that auditors need to think about all the time. So I really think that the focus on this has to be for everybody else, and really get back to the point that Barbara made earlier. Auditors do a very important job. Last point that I want to raise, and maybe somebody else can talk about it, is how's this going to affect audit fees for this year? I have heard that there's tremendous downward pressure on audit fees right now. What we're talking about is raising the amount of work that auditors are going to have to do. And I think that workload is going to go up substantially in order to address all of these questions and restore the integrity in the financial reporting process. So how are we going to address that? So one of the other things that you might want to consider is how you can have investors and audit committees understand that paying more for audit fees this year to make sure that these audit issues are well addressed may be one of the best uses that they can have for the stockholders' funds. Thank you.
Thank you. Ernie Ball.
Thank you. I want to agree with Dick on his comment regarding audit fees going up. If they don't go up this year, then somebody's not doing what they ought to be doing. And I think that our clients should anticipate that. As far as the type of issue we have listed that may be most significant, it's my opinion that the going concern issue is probably the most significant. It bears on virtually all the other issues that we have listed. All of those things come into being with the going concern decision, and I think that needs to be emphasized.
Thank you. Jeff Mahoney.
Thank you. I don't have a basis for recommending whether or not additional audit guidance is necessary in any of these areas, but as far as the issue of which of these areas are most significant, I would focus on three that you mentioned, at least from an investor perspective. The first one being fair value measurements. I was struck by an October letter from the American Banker Association to SEC Chairman Cox that indicated that a number of financial institutions, both large and small, at least the way I read the letter, are unlikely to comply with FSP 157.3 that you mentioned earlier. My reading of 157.3 is that it's an illustrative example of a principle that's in 157. So that raises concerns on my part as to whether or not some financial institutions, referring to their letter, large and small, are not complying with the principles in 157. That same letter also talks about other than temporary impairment, another issue you mentioned. You pointed out that it was a highly judgmental area. Your memo, though, however, also points out that we've had some guidance in that area for quite some time. There's guidance, as you mentioned, 115, SAB 59, EITF 9920. So again, based on comments in that letter and other comments I've seen publicly made, it raises an issue to me as to whether or not other than temporary impairment requirements as they exist today are being complied with. I would also point out Kurt's organization, CFA Institute, conducted a survey recently of their membership regarding what their members believe contributed to continuing volatility. And 75% of the membership, with one being not at all and five completely, 75% of their membership gave a rating of four or five to the concern that financial institutions continue to hold assets at values that do not accurately reflect current market value. So again, I think that suggests to me that those two areas, fair value measurements, other than temporary impairment, are significant areas. And the third one I'd point out, and another one that was on your list, was disclosures. Your memo talks about when there's volatility, and given this economic environment, that disclosures are very important. You mentioned risk and uncertainty. Certainly, that seems to be an important one. But also, there's some very good disclosures in 157 that many investors have been relying on or have found very helpful. Your memo also points out there's new disclosures that the FASB has issued on credit derivatives, which seems like another very pertinent area, another set of important disclosures. So I think those three areas are most significant: fair value measurement, other than temporary impairment, and disclosure area. Thank you.
Thank you. Lynn Turner.
I'd like to just come back to something that Dick said and maybe direct a question down to John on the MD&As, which do tie into a lot of this and ultimately what happens in the disclosures. Now, my experience has been is if you give the companies a heads up that here's the things you're going to focus on in reviews and all, and then someone like the PCAOB comes in and says, here's what we're going to focus on in our inspections next year coming out of it,
that people respond to that in a positive way. The companies usually then try to make sure that they do a good job of getting disclosure in those areas, and then the audit committees will spend more time, and so will the auditors, and it has a very positive outcome. Is the SEC, other than just in speeches, looking or considering something there in CorpFin, putting out some guidance? Again, we've got a almost a once-in-a-lifetime type fundamental shift going on in the economy and what companies are facing. Have the staff considered putting out some type of alert as well, saying, here are some things that people just need to be thinking about as they prepare their filings, and, you know, not just the things that are going to come out of TARP, because I think you've been out there talking about the implications of that for filings, but in general, just the reset that's going on in the economy, not only here but globally. Have you guys considered putting out something that says, hey, here's the things you need to be thinking at with the hope of improving disclosures that you're in?
Well, obviously, to this point, we've been doing it in, I guess I would say, small pieces since, I guess, all the way back to last December, even some thoughts that we put out, that I put out in a speech yesterday. I don't know that we've gotten far enough along to think whether we'd do something more comprehensive than that. I mean, I do think you'll see some more thoughts maybe in the 157 area.
I'd certainly encourage you to do something broader and kind of pull it all together. I think it was last year or the year before you put something out. Divisions put out things in the past of what it's focusing on.
There was something two or three years ago that was actually kind of an odd release at the time.
I would certainly encourage you to do it because we are going through a once-in-a-lifetime type event. I can't help but think it won't work out good for everyone if you guys would be willing to do that.
Okay, thank you. Joe Corsello.
A couple of things. In terms of what areas may be most important, kind of add some things to what has already been said. I think they're all important, but I'd probably pick four. One is going concern, which I think has been said already. The other is fraud. And the reason I say those two is because when the auditor is perceived to have failed in those two areas, it creates a major problem with the public. And when it creates a major problem with the public, it creates problems, obviously, for Congress and regulators. And so it's just a big issue. I think that's what investors focus on most closely is missing fraud, and to a lesser extent, missing a bankruptcy shortly after it happens. The third thing would be revenue recognition. In the work that I've done in fraud and others have done in fraud, and I think Walter Schutz one time said, when it comes to fraud, cooking the books, improper revenue recognition is the recipe of choice. And so they just tend to go there. And then the last would be fair value, which has also been said. And the reason for that is that's what everybody expects the auditor to be focusing on now, right? So if you miss it in fair value, people are going to say, well, are you alive? You know, everybody's focusing on that. So I think those would be the four areas. I want to respond a little bit to what Dick said. I don't disagree that the guidance could be very useful to management and to investors. And Dick said it shouldn't be useful to auditors. If it is useful to auditors, we got bigger problems. And I would agree with Dick that I think the major firms and probably some of the large regionals should be all over this. But Dick, I don't know if you've ever done CPE for some firms that are registered with the board. And unless the people in Ohio are a whole lot smarter, and maybe they are, the questions that I get are downright frightening. So I do think that there are some auditors who could benefit from this guidance. They don't have the luxury of the staff that Vin has in New York thinking about this stuff all the time. And then the last thing that I'd say is on the fee area. I do think the auditors are going to have to do more work, and I do think that has obvious implications for fees, and I do think they probably are having a lot of pressure put on them right now as it relates to fees. One of the things I would hope that the board is doing in their inspection process is if firm A is doing an audit, we'll just pick a number, for $5 million, and then the client switches to firm B, and firm B is doing the audit for $4 million. I hope the inspection staff is saying, well, why are you guys so much smarter and so much better than firm A, assuming these are both large firms. And unless there's a very persuasive answer there, that sounds to me like fee cutting. And in reality, most of the costs associated with an audit is professional practice time. So in all likely, hours have gone down, which you guys have the data to look at. And so if hours have gone down in this kind of environment, as a regulator, I hope you're troubled by that.
Thank you. David Becker.
Just very quickly to suggest a way perhaps of thinking through the question of whether you should issue guidance. It strikes me that guidance from regulators serves one of maybe four purposes, and I would think you ought to maybe look at this in this framework if it's useful. The first is to clear up some sort of ambiguity. People don't know what they're supposed to do, perhaps because the standards are either too particular or too general. We'll deal with that another time. The second is to remind people about what they ought to do, sort of literally remind them, oh, this is very complicated, I don't know, I forgot about that. Good thing you reminded me, PCAOB, which strikes me as that might be a little odd, but you never know. The third is to remind in a sort of finger-wagging way, which is to say, we don't have enough confidence that you're going to get it right without us putting some implied pressure on you. So we want to, quote, remind, unquote, auditors that they have to do X, Y, and Z. And then the fourth thing, it strikes me, that one might usefully do is to say, well, we want to issue a statement because we want to strengthen the hand of auditors in the eternal guerrilla warfare between auditors and management, so that when or the company, so that when the auditor is importuned not to do X, Y, and Z because it costs so much or because it leads to unpleasant result, the auditor can say, you know, I might be tempted to agree with you, but you know, those crazy guys at the PCAOB, they just sent this thing out telling us that we had to make sure that we did these things. So that, again, that just sort of strikes me as if one thinks of this in terms of the public policy objectives to be achieved by issuing guidance, I think it may help you through it.
David, I'm just kind of wondering, that's, I think, a helpful list of things to think about. Based on the discussion today, is there anything that you would think would trigger, do we meet any one of those four categories for a need for guidance? Just interested in your observations.
Well, I'm concerned that there hasn't been any discussion about the potential decline in legal fees. Beyond that, I don't think I have anything to add to the discussion. It's quite good.
But as I understood it, David, you were suggesting that we make sure that we answer one of these four questions before we issue the guidance. Were we clearing up an ambiguity, something ambiguous? Was it so important that we needed to remind people because it was just so urgent? Or maybe the guidance does, even though it repeats something out there, strengthens the hand. So you're suggesting we, in thinking this through, make sure we think of what we believe the reason is for the guidance. Yeah, I think it's very valuable. Thank you.
Larry Salva.
David's comments may have been a good setup for mine, in that, to try, go back to answer some of the questions of what might be most significant to address, I think that largely depends on the circumstances of each company and, you know, in each situation. Industries are going to be different. Companies are going to be affected differently. And also, it depends on the guidance, if you will, that is put out, or whether it's in fact guidance meeting one of the purposes that David outlined, or possibly a different purpose, which I think of as there are three parties involved here: the issuer, the preparer, the auditor, and the audit committee. And I think the objective here could be that we want to improve the quality of each of those, quality of the financial reporting, the quality of the audit of that financial reporting by the preparer, and the quality of the oversight of the preparation of the financial reporting and the auditing of that by the audit committee. Now, I recognize that the mission of the PCAOB is primarily to deal with the auditing profession, but as others have mentioned here, SOX puts a responsibility on management to have internal control over financial reporting, which clearly is implicated here if management fails to identify either the implications of the current environment on their financial reporting, accounting, as well as disclosures. While SOX doesn't technically get to MD&A, Lynn rightly pointed out that SAS 8 does put responsibilities on the auditor to read it for consistency, including the description of the business, how the business might be evolving, which might not even be in the MD&A, but might be in the description of business section of the fourth part of the 10K. So my view, technically, I guess, is more of this really needs to be a risk alert. That would be the kind of guidance that I think would be appropriate. And it could be a risk alert that is a financial reporting and audit risk alert that would be read by all constituents so that they could all do their respective jobs in the role of interplay between audit committee oversight. We'll all read it, and we'll all think about what applies in our circumstances and react appropriately. Hopefully, all react appropriately. But the objective very much could be to improve the quality of each one of those aspects of financial reporting.
We do have that tool, risk alert, effectively practice alert, which is the tool we used last year to issue guidance on fair value measurements. So that is a tool that could be the vehicle for this guidance. Thanks.
Sam Renzella.
Let me try to react to what would have been so far some very constructive comments. We have been at KPMG, we've been targeting all of these issues to some degree or not, for this has been now about 16 to 18 months that we've been living in this world, and it's been accelerating. So we've been putting out guidance for some time around these particular issues. We think we know what, we believe we've got our hands around the risks. We're putting out, to Larry's point, you've got to really dig down into the industry and sector levels now to really start to focus on, because certain sectors have moved into the crisis that weren't there maybe 6 months ago. So we're working on sector-led guidance. So I don't, just speaking for us, I don't think we're looking for anything directly from the board, but surely would not object to something along the lines that Larry talked about, which is a risk alert with a focus on financial reporting as well. The last thing I would like to cover is David Becker's comments around the four reasons one might put out guidance, and the last one, which would be for auditors to have I'll embellish here a bit, auditors to have a stick to throw in front of their clients on why they might be doing something. I just assume we didn't have that. We're all big boys and big girls, and we know what the requirements are, and I think we can explain to our clients why we believe a procedure is necessary and not look to the board with respect to blaming why we might be doing something. I would hope that we'd have enough judgment and enough integrity to do that without that need.
Thank you. Galen Hansen.
I happen to agree with you on that last comment, Sam. I don't know what kind of stick you'd give to the auditor anyway, and I think a lot of what we're talking about here is already out there. I mean, the guidance is there. Maybe it's a practice alert reminder of some sort. There's actually a lot of information on going concern. I am troubled, though, by the 94-6, the risks and uncertainties. Why are not these things being disclosed in financial statement footnotes? Why aren't they being discussed more in MD&A? And to that extent, I think that would be a ripe area for some additional reminders. You know, how many of these people have actually read 94-6? You've got to wonder, given the content of that, based on what we've been seeing happening, particularly in the area of what it talks about severe impact and severe impact within the next 12 months and whether those sorts of things are being disclosed in the footnotes. Lynn mentioned earlier, you know, the auditor's responsibility to read the document. I think more definitive guidance has always been questionable in terms of what is expected in with particular MD&A. And in MD&A, you know, you read it, and then what do you do with it? Should there be some sort of reporting responsibility in connection with that, I think, has always been an open question.
Kurt Schott.
I just have to say that your guidance and your support and your hand-holding and even reminders in this moment have to be welcomed and encouraged in all cases, in our view. On the issue of going concern, there has been some discussion in our organization amongst our members about how audit will handle or should handle and assess and report on firms that are participating and somewhat dependent on the TARP program, the equity infusion program, the money market guarantee program, the commercial paper guarantee program, if I missed any. So how is that to be dealt with in terms of the going concern analysis?
John Morrissey.
Yeah, thank you. I guess just a couple points. I think it's a good list as usual. I think it's very insightful, like, you know, in violent agreement with virtually the views that have been put forward today. I would like to address two points. One was the question of whether or not the auditors understand what the new risks are and where the areas of focus should be. On the receiving end of the floggings that have increased in the severity, I can tell you they do get it, and they're communicating it to their clients, and they're also been very good about communicating that it's going to cost more. And I think that's all fair. But just from one person's perspective, I can tell you they get it, but certainly wouldn't hurt to reinforce the guidance and get it out there for all to see, not just auditors. The other thing I'd ask you to think about is that the list that you put forward is a great list for today. The pressures that the economy is under today and the auditors are under today and companies are under today. But if you look forward even further and you're hopeful like I am, things are going to improve and things are going to start getting better. And as we emerge from this, other things are going to become interesting as well. And what kind of brought this to focus for me was I was reading a transcript of a CFO that was saying, we had a $2.5 billion loss this quarter related to mark-to-market adjustments. We think our actual losses are going to be in the range of $100,000 to $200,000. And I started thinking about that. I said, wow, if this guy's right, and he seemed like a pretty smart guy, when this starts to turn, he's sitting on over $2 billion of profits that are going to come out at some point. And I started thinking, I wonder how that's going to come out. Things tend to go down pretty quickly. Gravity with auditors tends to be something that they like. But going the other way, it's going to be interesting to see how quickly it goes back up, how quickly it should go back up, and whether or not the market reacts to those increases in they like it better in big lumps or they like it better in small pieces. And it's just going to be really interesting. There's going to, I think, need to be some sensitivity to what happens down the road as we start to kind of go out of the cycle, which hopefully we will soon. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you for that comment. And I think we've observed that in financial reporting in the past where coming out of cycles, very large reserves were built up, and then
how are they dealt with in future financial reporting? So your comment is a good reminder that it's not just on the downside, but as things turn around on the upside, accounting issues emerge as well, and auditing issues.
Howard Johnson.
One other aspect to take a look at, since nobody else has mentioned it, is perhaps if you can issue some guidance, put out something about looking at the consistency and perhaps more involvement in the quarterly review of the financials. Although it's not an audit, and you're reading a lot of stuff, it is an opportunity to ask a lot of probing questions on a lot of these topics, which may be appropriate. You know, some of these topics are more appropriate to some organizations than others, but you could tailor them. To me, it's an opportunity that you wouldn't want to miss. It's also a chance to perhaps take a look at the governance process and meet with some of the key players in the governance process within that organization, internal auditors, legal, risk management folks, finance personnel, see if what's going on with their groups, any changes in reporting relationships. Did anybody just hike up and leave for no reason? That kind of thing. I think it also matches things like the audit committee is interested in, what's going on with the management or the governance process in organizations. So I add that to the hopper.
Thank you. John Kellis.
Thank you. A lot of interesting points have been raised, and sometimes you just have to issue guidance of this sort, but I think the points about the purpose of the guidance are extremely important, and I think that before preparing or issuing any further guidance, you ought to be very clear as to your purpose in doing this. In principle, I'm with Mr. Dietrich, who says surely this isn't necessary for auditors, but to the extent that there are comments that are making the point that yes, there are indeed auditors who need some assistance in this way, then that provides a rationale for producing guidance and also may help in its focus. And it seems to me that PCAOB is in a particularly special position to have an idea as to what sort of guidance auditors might require because of your inspection system, and you may or may not, but you may have seen weaknesses in the past which in the current environment become more important. The second point, though, is there is an awful lot of guidance floating about, and I think that if one is just issuing guidance for the sake of it, one ought to not to do so, because at present there's a sense in which preparers, auditors, everyone is being overburdened with assistance, and particularly if you look internationally where many jurisdictions are producing guidance. And related to that is the question of consistency, and an example of that arose recently in the fact that the International Accounting Standards Board has been preparing a paper on fair value measurement and disclosure by some experts, which had been produced in draft. After that had been produced in draft, FASB and the SEC issued some questions and answers, I think it was probably the SEC, the tone of which, never mind the substance, the tone of which was rather different from the IASB's guidance, and this was followed by a statement by IASB that it was all the same. And really what it comes down to is the more that you say about things, the more you run the risk of different nuances coming out, and the more you run the risk of confusing those who you are actually intending to help.
Thank you. Lynn Turner.
I think David's points about why to do it are pretty good. I think it does help the auditors in some difficult positions, although I hate when the auditors come in to me in an audit committee and say, hey, we got to do this because PCAOB put out some guidance, when it's just common sense to turn around and do it. So I'd hope the auditors wouldn't do it. But I think David's right on with why to do it. And this is all about human behavior. And, you know, if you can buck up the auditors a little bit in what is probably the toughest job in business, then so be it. I think that that's beneficial. They're going to have a very, very tough job this year. And if you can help them out a little bit, I'd certainly encourage you to do that. There are a couple other points, though. When you look back over the past and you see where the auditors didn't get the job done right, quite often information was out there that they didn't pay attention to. There were red flags, information available in the marketplace. And one thought that comes to mind is on Lehman Brothers, over a year ago, I was getting a number of questions from investors as well as from the media, seriously challenging whether or not you could trust any of their valuations on their assets, especially some of their portfolios. And you had a large group of people already questioning what was going into that financial statement. And certainly when I was at Glass Lewis, we looked at the information that the firms used, and I think quite often the auditors, the audit teams weren't getting all the information, for example, that was available to the street and weren't factoring that in. And I think that's incredibly useful information. I think the auditors, especially this year, are going to need to take off the blinders and consider everything. Someone mentioned the governance stuff. There's the compensation stuff that people are going to have to take a look at. Why are people in such... I think this is a year where you'd probably need to spend more time with the operational people than with the finance and accounting groups. It's the operational people that are going to know how you're going to come out and going to do. And I think if the auditors sit there in the audit room and don't get out and spend some time with the top divisional people and the top operating officers, they're going to miss the boat there. Another one is on the whistleblower program. Someone mentioned fraud. And we now know from some research that auditors, internal or external, just typically do not find fraud. They're the lowest detector of that there is. And the highest detection source seems to be the whistleblower programs or TIPS. And yet I found that audit partners don't understand whether or not the whistleblower programs are working within the organizations, how they work, where they're working, and whether or not they're really independently sourcing those tips up to the audit committee or an independent source outside of management. And I think it would be, especially as pressure goes on to management to make the numbers, areas like revenue recognition have been mentioned, I don't understand how auditors could not literally this year go in and look at the whistleblower programs, really understand whether they're working or not, and make sure they've got their hands around that, because that is the number one detector of fraud. The auditors are also starting to send some of this work offshore to India and elsewhere to be done. And I think the auditors, as they start to go offshore with this work and have more of the audit work done outside the country, some of the basic audit work, I think they have to make sure they've got the right controls or supervision, because God save them if they have one of these audits blow up and it turns out that that audit work was done over in India. That will be a front page New York Times article, and God won't be able to save you from the outcome on that one if there's a problem. So I think people need to be aware as they change the way they're doing audits in a scenario like this, they have to be sensitive to that.
Thank you. Craig Jonas.
Thanks, Jennifer. Now let me violently pile on to something Larry Selvis said. And when he was speaking, I was reminded of the trip my wife and I took down the Colorado River in a dory. And we were going down the river with guides who had been doing this for 25-plus years, and they were very skilled at it. But without fail, prior to getting to a Class 5 rapids, they would pull off to the side, and they'd get out, and they'd talk about the rapids. Scouting, they called it, scouting the rapids. But the notion was, look down the rapid and say, see that big rock to the left? Stay right. You know, yesterday I saw a guy, he crashed into the rock just in front of it. Stay left. It's kind of a risk alert. Where are the big rocks? Who crashed last time around? And let's be wise about trying to avoid it. It's very much of a coaching kind of tone, as opposed to a tone of, you know, you've got 521 things you need to do, and let me just count them for you. This is much more of a let me help you keep out of trouble kind of tone. And I remember in practice, it was among the best memos I would read during the year, because you read it with your own clients in mind, specific companies in mind, and you think as you go about, oh my gosh, yes, I've got that problem. And it might not even be the exact problem, it's an analogous problem, but you triggered a thought. And I think that's the highest and best use of the document, is to trigger the creative thought needed to spot the rocks and stay left or right as appropriate in the circumstances. If you bought into that logic, key to making this work then are two things. One, avoid the temptation to take a list of 20 items and say the top two are these, because they're very client dependent. You know, fair value may be very relevant for a firm heavy into financial instruments. It may be irrelevant to a widget maker, but inventory obsolescence is everything, maybe to the widget maker. And then the last point I'll make is time is relevant here too. There's a cycle that the audit firms go through, that companies go through, of course, in preparing their books and records. And, you know, the time to sit and reflect about this is often over the holidays. So, like, by Thanksgiving, wouldn't it be great to have something in people's hands that they could sit and read and reflect? These are kind of reflective documents. They're not study, take notes, kind of, but reflective kind of documents. And hopefully by Thanksgiving would be a time to have it out, best case, I would think.
Thanks for those comments. Ms. Kantner?
Hi. Auditors are responsible for looking in places where there is a risk of material misstatement. And clearly, everything on the list, plus the ones that have been added, are potential areas of a risk of material misstatement. So, Greg, I thumbs up your idea that none of these should be given a priority, because depending upon my particular client, any one of them can have an extreme priority that is totally different than the next client. Secondly, I would say, representing the smaller CPA firms, guidance is always welcome. But usually the very first question after you read the guidance is, and is there something different? Is there something new? Is there something that doesn't exist elsewhere? And so the concept of risk alert tells you there isn't something new here. We're just reminding, and we're directing, and we are giving you thinking and talking points. Many of these year-end audits are already underway with regard to interim and planning. So time would be of the essence to incorporate this thought process quickly before the year-end gets away from you. So I would simply say, make sure that the guidance is clear, that we are either reiterating something that already exists or emphasizing a current economic condition, for example, and not perhaps providing new guidance to address an ambiguity, for example. And if we are creating new guidance, that we ensure the reader understands that pretty transparently. Thank you.
Thank you. Tom Linsmeyer.
I wanted to react to John's comments about the expert advisory panel draft report and the language that came out of the FASB staff and the OCA staff position, as well as our FSP. The two boards had a joint meeting on Monday and Tuesday, and we've made a commitment moving forward to, if wherever possible and at all times possible, to be issuing guidance in words that are identical, to limit the potential political arbitrage or reporting arbitrage to the race to the lowest common denominator that we're seeing existing in these markets at this time. That still remains a challenge in certain areas, especially fair value, because we have specific guidance framework in the United States for fair value where the ISB does not. And so the tone of an expert panel report has to be one of best practices and suggestions rather than interpretation of guidance. But despite those challenges, we've made a commitment to each other to try to write identical words on a go-forward basis as systematically as possible.
Thanks, Tom. Warren Momquist.
Thank you.
I'm reminded that there's just one statement, one sentence in the SOX Act that requires an audit committee to receive certain information in regards to the risk, and I believe this is interpreted as meaning risk to the financial statements. I don't mean to be out of school on this, but to many of us auditors, we have our head into the past, but that means our backsides are into the future. And while we, as issuers, certainly in the 10K, have a list of risk factors, so many of those are these large, audacious risks that could take the company down. And then there, within audit committee meetings, there is discussions with the external auditors in regards to what risks currently reside in the financial statements, but there's very little discussion in terms of what happens in between. What are those other risks that are future-oriented that will result as from our current business products, our services, revenues, certain accounting elections that have been taken, and or tax? So I think that there is a need for some more specific guidance in this area, and I think that I believe that this guidance should come forth both for management and as well for the external auditors as to what types of risks should be discussed and for what periods of time, especially those related to the future.
Thank you. Finn Coleman.
Yeah, I just thought I'd have one other suggestion, and we use it as a tool in our firm. So, we've already put out in writing something that you're describing here, which is a risk alert. Nothing's changed, but it's reminders in various areas, and we update it. But we use a second tool, and the other tool is webcasts, so that if the objective here, which I think I'm hearing, is nothing's new, but you're trying to remind people, raise awareness, and assist the system in doing it better, higher quality. I know it's not something that's been done before, but perhaps, a different form of communication in addition to the writing just might be very helpful, particularly if you're targeting, firms that do not have the resources to be able to explain each of these areas and those risks. When you're consolidating them, I mean, we do that for 20,000 people at a pop. And if you do that for certain people, there might be people that really could help. Now, I don't know. I know that would be a little bit unprecedented, but maybe just something to think about.
Yeah, that is a very good point. I think, as you know, we have the small business forums where we do go around the country and invite auditors from the smaller firms to hear us talk about the risks that we're observing from inspections, enforcement, as well as these kind of issues. So that's one vehicle, but you're suggesting some other interesting one. Thanks.
Well, and of course, this discussion today, like all of our SAG meetings, is also webcast, and I think that helps raise awareness as well. But point taken. Gary Kubrick.
Thank you, and unfortunately, I missed the first 30 minutes of the meeting because of my flight, so hopefully this is not redundant. But sitting here as a preparer, as an ex-auditor in this environment, if you were going to put out guidance, I'm not suggesting if you should or shouldn't, but if you did, things that at least would be apparent to me should be in it, is a reminder on bias. I mean, we've heard things about consistency and comparativeness, but a lot of it comes down to bias. In bad times, bias can go in either direction. It doesn't go any direction in good times as well, but in bad times it could be, let's throw in the kitchen sink and everything else to set us up for a future period. Alternatively, the bias could be going the other way, is we're going to do everything we can to maximize this year's results. I mean, so it can cut either way depending on circumstance and company, but it's a thought if you're giving out guidance. Just a reminder, a lot of this is sort of bias sort of transcends a lot of the tactical issues, and at least tactical questions in my view. I think with respect to other asset impairments, I start thinking about long-term contracts and long-term programs where you might have long-term advanced tooling, long-term capitalized software. The question is, are you now, since the world has changed so much, still committed to these programs? And even if you are as a company, is the marketplace or your customer or vendor, that might be important to seeing it through committed as well. So again, it's sort of a how to execute inside some potential asset impairments. Again, I would look for total commitment through all members of the value chain, customers, management, vendors, and so forth. Another thing is, reading the paper, a lot of companies are starting to downsize staff. They're starting to do other forms of reorganizations and stuff. And this really gets more to the audit thing, is if you're making changes late in the year, should the wrong staffing changes, the wrong organizational changes, could that rise to a material weakness that the people responsible for the integrity of the accounts and so forth, are the right people still in the right place with the right tools and so forth, or have their resources been constricted enough that you might have a longer-term problem? And then lastly, when I look at the September 30th joint FASB SEC release on FIN 157, I mean, they made the point there at least three times directly that judgments or significant judgments by management are critical to this. I'm not so sure it made it into the 157 statement itself, but looking at that press release, I think gets to, well, what's a reasonable judgment? I don't know what sort of guidance should be given for that, whether it's to the auditing firms through one of your releases or to your several months from now when people are auditing, when your field inspectors are auditing the audit firms, is what is reasonable judgment and what would, work inside tolerable limits, to your inspection process. Thank you.
Thanks, Gary. I don't see any more 10 cards up, and I feel that this discussion, therefore, is about ready to come to a close, which is pretty much right on schedule. Having started off this discussion, I want to thank everybody for adding to our list that kind of just teed up some ideas as to where additional risks might be, and some very, very thoughtful comments were made about where other risks might lie that we should consider, and we certainly will do that. The second comment is, once or twice someone said, don't know what form of guidance this would take, to the point that many made that this is, if it's reminding people about existing guidance, that would be in the form of a practice alert. If it were new guidance, that would have to come out in the form of a standard. I think most of what I heard around the table was really not comments about the need for new standards, but comments about potentially the need for reminders around why this economic environment and the challenges of this environment might cause the need for reminders in certain areas. So that if there were guidance, it would probably most likely be in the area of a practice alert to that point. Jennifer?
That said, I thank you very much for your comments. I certainly agree with what Marty said, and this has been very helpful. So I think with that, then, Marty, I'll turn it back over to you to lead our discussion on audit quality indicators.
Well, thank you. We'll now turn to another topic. One or two people are getting refreshments, and please feel free to get up and do that. As we begin the second subject for today. The second subject is a discussion on the feasibility of audit quality indicators. Recently, the Treasury Advisory Committee on the Auditing Profession came out with a number of recommendations in their report that touched on various aspects of the auditing profession and several recommendations about things that the PCAOB should consider. One of the recommendations was that the PCAOB should determine, in consultation with others, thus this discussion today, the feasibility of developing key indicators of audit quality and effectiveness. And once determined whether it was feasible to come up with key indicators of audit quality, consider requiring auditing firms to publicly disclose those indicators. Today, we'd like to keep the discussion primarily focused around the feasibility of developing key indicators of audit quality. Some of the sources of information that we're going to use today for this discussion, there's been quite a bit of academic research around audit quality over the years, and I'll touch on that in a moment or two. In addition to that, the UK's Financial Reporting Council studied audit quality to quite an extent over the past couple of years and issued their own study on the subject, including an audit quality framework. In that regard, the audit quality framework and the European Union's eighth directive on statutory audits, we've asked Richard Fleck, partner at a major law firm in the UK, but also the chair of the Auditing Practices Board and the head of and a director of the Financial Reporting Council, to join us today. Richard has been with the Financial Reporting Council for over 20 years, a lawyer by training, but working with the profession for over 20 years. Richard, you can show folks where you are, and we thank you for joining us. In addition to that, the recommendation of the advisory committee itself will be discussed, and some of the comments received by the advisory committee will be discussed by Damon Silver. Has Damon arrived yet?
No.
Well, possibly it will be discussed by me. I was with Damon earlier this morning. He had a speaking obligation, but he ensured me that he would be here by 2:10 when this session started, so I expect he'll be here momentarily. Turning to the academic studies, and there have been many over the years that we've taken a look at, one thing in common with them was that there really was no definition of audit quality, and the academics struggled to some extent about that. One definition that we did see in a study early on that was used by others in their studies is shown here in this slide, as the market-assessed joint probability that a given auditor will both discover a breach in the client's accounting system and report that breach. I think that's a good definition. Probably many around this table could come up with other definitions, but certainly in academic studies, that's one that has been used quite a bit. The studies, though, have gone on to move away from the need to define audit quality and said, well, look at it from a couple of different perspectives. There are both input factors that are relevant to audit quality and to assessing it, and there are output factors that are relevant to understanding audit quality and assessing it. And both of those are addressed, and both have some strengths and some limitations. The Treasury's Advisory Committee paper noted both of these types of factors and talked about them a bit. Let me just comment for a moment. You know, input-based factors talked about in the paper are things such as the industry experience of the team, the amount of time that an engagement partner might spend on the job, the relationship between partner time, staff time on audits, training in the firm, and other aspects around the people in the organization and the steering of the audit engagement itself, either at an engagement level or in the firm taken as a whole. But those are the input factors that are often discussed. Output-based factors most often talked about tend to be, well, how did the audit turn out at the end of the day? Was the opinion the correct opinion given the facts and circumstances? How often are the financials restated in that particular organization? What's the status of litigation in a particular firm or enforcement actions? And also, what are the results of both the firm's own internal peer review, internal reviews of its own results, its peer reviews, as well as inspections by its audit regulators? Output factors, input and output factors have been pointed out as being good, and in many cases have been pointed out as having challenges. Some input factors, when they're pointed out, say they can be relevant, but could have unintended consequences depending upon the extent to which certain parties made them very prominent. Relationships could change of staff time to partner time, but maybe inappropriately so. And people could manage to certain input factors if they became important. Output-based factors maybe emerge only over time. One might think something is of high quality to find out 2 or 3 years later that it needed to be restated or that litigation resulted from the audit itself. So measurement challenges have been pointed out in academic studies, and measurement challenges are pointed out in the Treasury paper that Damon Silvers chaired, to whom I referred a moment ago. And Damon, welcome. Thanks for joining us. The GAO has performed a couple of studies that have touched on this. And 2003 report, the GAO defined audit quality as an audit performed in accordance with generally accepted auditing standards to provide reasonable assurance that the statements and related disclosures are presented in accordance with GAAP and not materially misstated due to fraud or error. In a later study, they included other factors such as the input type factors I just discussed. Experience and technical capability of the audit firm, partners and staff are relevant. The capability to efficiently respond to a client's need, and the capability to identify and communicate material reporting issues in financial reports are key indicators of audit quality as well. So again, numerous studies have been done. We've talked about audit quality in one way or another around this table many times. And I think the recommendation of the Treasury Advisory Committee was, and we'll hear from Damon on this in a moment, was take a look at this very hard, PCAOB, consult with others, academics, the profession, audit committee members, and get input on, are there reasonable measures of audit quality and key indicators? If they are, consider having firms collect that data, then study it, consider whether or not that data should be monitored by the PCAOB, and consider whether that data should be ultimately disclosed and reported. So taking these recommendations very seriously as we are, today we will expend a significant amount of time. We'll move from here at about 10 after 3. We'll take a break and then go to the breakout sessions, which we've talked about in the papers that were sent to you, where questions will be taken up from the perspective of investors, from the perspective of issuers, from the perspective of auditors, to get some really in-depth thought around the subject of audit quality, and we'll come back again about on this tomorrow morning. But right now let me turn to Richard Fleck. And Richard, we'd be very interested in your perspectives on the study that was done by the Financial Reporting Council on audit quality and your views, and the floor is yours. Thank you.
Well, Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. It's a great privilege and somewhat forbidding to be here and talking about these things, and I'll do my best to try and add a little bit to your discussion. May I open by saying I'm not trying in the course of these comments to answer, if I may put it this way, the question that the Treasury Committee has put to you. I wouldn't presume to do so. What I'm trying to do is to explain what we've done, some of the lessons that we've learned, some of the thoughts we have as to how things get taken forward in the future, and I guess also some of the trends that came through about audit quality and the process of our effort. If I may, I'll start by explaining what we did, why we did it, and where we've got to, and then how we will react in the future. The FRC began this project really because of two themes that had emerged in public discussion. The first was a totally inappropriate general usage of the term audit failure. It was being used by all sorts of commentators and individuals and members of the investment community to reflect a number of different things that included a concern that key information wasn't being provided to investors, notwithstanding that that was really a financial reporting issue. The word failure, audit failure, was being used in respect of accounting treatments that analysts and others didn't feel was entirely appropriate, and it was used in circumstances where events that were plainly external and intervening events came to light after the financial statements had been audited, with comments being made that the original audit had been defective. Now, in saying that, I'm not defending the substance. I just want to make the point that the term audit failure was being used in that context as a generic term. And it led us to question whether that was the right terminology. And it was also linked to the fact that there was increasing discussion about the role of audit standards in relation to audit quality and the extent to which they were the means by which business community could be assured of audit quality. And I think there was concern, frankly, that people would think that auditing standards could play that role and be a surrogate for audit quality in the generality. The second issue was that there was also an increasing recognition that the audit is not your usual product or service in today's open market, competition-driven and transparent marketplace. In one sense, it's like a high jumper getting over a bar. You don't know whether an audit has cleared that bar by 1 centimeter or by 1 foot or 1 meter. The audit, you have no measure of the quality of the audit and the quality of the assurance that's given as a result of the audit. And secondly, unlike most circumstances where somebody buys a product, you don't get a situation where the purchaser, the client, knows and has an input into the design or construct of the product. The shareholder doesn't indicate what he or she wants as part of the audit. That's in fact done by a third party, the preparer of the audit committee. So there's a triangular situation which does not result in the person who the audit is ultimately intended for being a designer of the product, and he doesn't have an ability to say whether he wants a Rolls Royce or, dare I say it, a Skoda. In other words, there's a definitional problem. And as Martin said just now, there is also no easy definition of an audit. I remember that when we were discussing this with the Institute of Chartered Accountants, and they were saying, oh yes, there is, I said to them, well look, there used to be a set of cartoons which used to say love is dot 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 dot, and then somebody finished the sentence off. Well, you finish off the sentence audit quality is dot 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 dot, and we sent them away with that project, and they came back with exactly the same as all the academic learning, which is a combination of inputs and outputs, and the confidence that you get from that being a definition in their eyes of audit quality. And I would argue that that isn't a definition, it's merely an explanation of what goes into audit quality. So the FRC decided that it should undertake a project to really make sure it understood all the drivers that determine a quality audit, and then should assess what the threats were to those drivers and how we could ensure that the right drivers, the right incentives, existed within the firms. So it was a combination of identifying the drivers of audit quality, working out what the threats were to those drivers, and then how we could best assure and stimulate the existence of those drivers in the firms. And we did the same sort of thing as you described earlier, Marty. We reviewed the academic writings, the approach that had been taken by various different organizations, and we looked both in the UK and internationally. And what we did was to produce a discussion paper, 67-page discussion paper, which was really the follow-up to a document, the documents that we produced in the past in relation to fraud and aggressive earnings management, and which were designed to identify the issues, throw up some questions, and get people to respond in as informative and constructive way as possible. And that was published, and it highlighted and divided the drivers into five categories, the categories that you have in your papers: a culture of the firm, the skills and personal qualities of the staff and the personnel, the effectiveness of the actual audit process, the reliability and usefulness of the output, and also the external factors that could be material. And just to jump ahead, external factors includes things like the company being audited's approach to corporate governance, and things of that nature, including, most importantly, the role of regulation. What the paper did not do was try to identify ways of measuring these drivers and to discuss the extent to which those could be quantified and therefore reviewed. But throughout the paper, there are a number of areas where it's clear that measurement could be achieved, and one particular area, which was a constant theme through all of the threats to audit quality, which was the structure of the audit firms and the level of experience that personnel and staff within the audit firms have. And if you ever save you looking it up, there's an appendix at the back of the paper, which was prepared with the assistance of the four major firms, which gave the percentages of people's experience in the UK. And I'm summarizing, but the 5.8% of the personnel were partners, 46.5% were at the assistant manager and manager level, and 45% were students. And the implications of that to the level of experience being brought to audit teams is self-evident, I would suggest. And one of the themes that comes through the paper throughout the paper is concern about whether there are adequate numbers of experienced auditors to mentor students and therefore develop people with adequate expertise to undertake audits, whether you have the bulk of the work being done by people who have enough experience to read and identify issues and carry them forward, and whether the senior members of staff have the time and the opportunity, given deadlines and so forth, to undertake an adequate review and assessment of any issues brought forward. So I just flag that, because when discussing this with Marty and with Damon earlier on, I didn't make the point at all to them that we had actually looked at a number of the metrics quite carefully, and that there are some quite significant, in our eyes, lessons to be learned from them.
Richard, if I can just make one point, I think just for comparison purposes, when you use the term students, we probably refer to that class over here as staff accountants in their first through third year. And I think that's what you're referring to as well.
I am, effectively.
Thank you.
At least, Marty, I think I am. before somebody tells me I've got it wrong. John, have I got that right? They're the same?
Yeah.
I need some help there, sorry.
Thank you.
The response to the paper was in one sense extremely encouraging, because people didn't argue with it. The paper was thought to cover the bulk of the issues and the drivers. Of course, people had different ways of expressing particular points, and of course people gave more emphasis to one area rather than another and said that we got the balance wrong. But the elements were all there. The profession argued that we had given inadequate weight to the external factors that I mentioned earlier: the role of regulators, the importance of their reputation, the role of audit committees, and the significance of reporting deadlines. And I mention that only because I think it was a fair comment on their part that those are factors, and therefore things that one at least has to recognize in the discussion. Having got the paper published and having had the responses, we then had quite a lengthy discussion about what to do with what we'd learned. Obviously, there was a lot of learning, but could we put it to some constructive use? And that, I think, is what takes us nearer to where the Treasury Committee was. And we were helped in this because the Statutory Audit Directive had passed, had provided that firms should provide what's called a transparency report, which covers about a dozen items, some of which are utterly boring, like what's the structure of the firm, but four of them are relevant to this in that they covered the internal quality control system, when the firm was last the subject of an external quality assurance review, a statement by the firm as to its approach to independence practices, and its approach to continuing education. But we felt, looking at our paper and what we'd learned, that more could be done through this means, and as a result, we distilled the 67 pages and what we'd learned into what we called the Audit Quality Framework, which has, in less than five pages, the summary of those points and the sort of things that people might consider, and I think that's in the papers that you have before you.
They're on page 23 and 24 of the briefing paper.
We published that document with a statement that we would be looking to see the extent to which firms reported against the framework, and with the clear expectation that the UK's Audit Inspection Unit would review the appropriateness of the comments that were made by firms in relation to those headings. So where we got to effectively was that the framework was out there in the public, people were expected to report against it, and we would be using the inspection regime to review the statements that were made. Obviously, there are some concerns about this. I mean, it isn't a complete answer to the question. What do we do if firms don't report against it? What happens if we just get rather, if you forgive my language, saccharine-style boilerplate comments which tell us what we want to hear but don't really say very much? What if there's no data on which you can actually bite? What if the information behind the statements is insubstantial and incapable of being adequately reviewed? And so we've made it clear that we would be considering the framework as we went forward. We would assess the way in which firms responded to our suggestion as to how they should proceed. And we are prepared, if necessary, to consider requiring the provision of particular information, including particular data. There are a number of points I think I should make briefly just before closing. The first is that, of course, we have looked at this from the perspective of audit quality within the firm as a whole. We've not looked at it in this particular paper from the perspective of each individual audit, although it is not difficult to see how you could carry that or translate some of the thinking across to an individual audit. And we didn't go into how we would, the sort of measurement data that we would seek were we to go for specific data. We have in fact done so. We have some headings and some thoughts built in some areas along the same lines as your thinking, but along some other thinking as well, as to how measurement could be brought to specific data. And if it becomes necessary to do so, as I've said, we will consider seriously requiring firms to do that. At the individual audit level, we've discussed, but we have not yet taken action, in providing guidance to audit committees as to how they might evaluate audit proposals, where there would be clearly be opportunities for very specific data to be assessed, in particular, taking the theme again of the experience of the audit team and its experience in the particular sector. It would not be difficult at all to have audit committees asking for that information. And if the users felt that was important to their understanding of why a particular audit firm was chosen, it would not be impossible for an audit committee chairman to report that or include that in the annual report, that analysis in the annual report. So I think we've made some steps in the right direction. Marty, I'm not going to claim that we have all the answers, nor do I claim that we have addressed specifically aspects of the Treasury's Treasury Committee's recommendation. But we have moved forward through a consultation process that's carried with us all of the constituencies, including, I emphasize, the users. We know how we would react to a number of different, or the thing, areas we would think about in reacting to the ways in which this develops. And we've made a commitment publicly to review the progress in this area and make such amendments as we think appropriate in the future. I hope that's a helpful way of explaining where we've got to and may trigger some thoughts. Thank you very much indeed.
Richard, thank you very much for those comments. We appreciate that input and the thought process that the Financial Reporting Council went through in its development of a framework around audit quality. And that framework was considered by the advisory committee and suggested that we think of that framework as we went ahead with our work. We'd now like to turn it over to Damon Silvers. Damon, of course, a member of the SAG and was the chair of the subcommittee on concentration and competition of the Advisory Committee on the Auditing Profession, to hear a little bit, Damon, about the recommendation itself and your thought process in making it.
Well, thank you, Marty, and it's a pleasure to hear from Richard. You know, this is sort of a strange assignment. I'm asked to report on one from one advisory group to another, and I'm trying to. A certain amount of advice is going to obviously come into this somewhere. The Treasury Committee on the Future of Auditing as a Profession was a number of people in this room served on it. We benefited enormously from the involvement of both the PCAOB and the SEC. Dan Gelser was assigned to the to my subcommittee, the Competition and Concentration Subcommittee, and was just enormously helpful. Zavanna Palmeros from the SEC, whom I gather is no longer the SEC no longer has the benefit of her help at this point. Zavanna was the SEC's designee to our committee, and again, it just brought a wealth of knowledge. We were in a somewhat odd position of being. Of having a committee of on the future of the auditing profession with no auditors, the subcommittee, not the committee as a whole, but our subcommittee was composed of investor and issuer representatives, and a lawyer. Some of us were also lawyers, but one law firm partner, and so having the assistance of the commission and the board was particularly valuable to me, and I wanted to take the opportunity to express my gratitude. I think in understanding the recommendation on the disclosure of audit quality indicators, I think it's important to begin with the title of our subcommittee. We were the Committee on Concentration and Competition, and so we were interested in measures that would enhance that would use the competitive process to enhance the future of auditing as a profession. Right. We were not the firm structure committee. There was a firm structure committee, and we were not the human capital committee. There were committees with those assignments. And so the lens that we looked at this through was the lens of the market and the decision-making process by customers, by consumers of audit services for those services. And in that one element of that question, obviously, is the amount of information and transparency available to market actors, both to CFOs and their staffs, to audit committees, and to investors who ratify the audit selection choice the preparer makes. We should note that one of our subcommittees and the full committee's other recommendations was that a variety of means be used to ensure that investor ratification votes were universal in our public companies. And so we had in mind this three-layered structure of decision-making. And the issue of what information do people have? I could say that our subcommittee came up with this recommendation out of the fullness of our imaginations. It really was. That's not so. It came from a comment letter that we received from a retired audit firm partner who chose to remain anonymous. It's really a tribute to the quality of that letter. Drove this recommendation, because usually anonymous stuff kind of a certain discount is applied to anonymous things generally in life, This was not the case here. This individual made a compelling argument that it would be very helpful in the process of audit selection and oversight to have a little bit more information. And the committee and our subcommittee felt quite passionately about this. And the impetus beyond the thoughtfulness of that letter really came from the audit that from the members of our subcommittee who served on audit committees of public companies. And in a way, this is a very interesting fact, because one would think that audit committee members would be in a position to obtain whatever information they wished about the quality of the quality of the engagement itself and the quality of the firm as a whole that they are doing business with. The more I've thought about this in preparing for this this afternoon's discussion, the more telling I think it is that that's where the push came from for this recommendation. The comment letter we received did have some suggested metrics that ought to be disclosed, and we had some discussion about that, and we chose not to include them in our report. And I think the reason why we did so, and I think this is extremely important in terms of the discussion here at the SAG and then whatever the board chooses to do, the reason we did so was not because we as a committee had any doubt that we thought that some disclosure of additional data that could be used in a competitive process was needed. Now, the language of the report does leave the possibility open that the PCAOB might find upon close examination that this is an impractical recommendation. But that was not the view of the subcommittee. We unanimously felt that there ought to be, that there are metrics that are worth disclosing and that they can be done in a productive way. We did not wish to impose upon the board what those metrics should be or exactly how to do it. We felt that was something best left to this process that we begin here today. That being said, I think that there are three models that potentially that we ought to consider today as possibilities, and maybe more than three, but there are three that I've been able to think of, and that the board ought to consider going forward after our discussions. The first model is, I think, what the individual who wrote to us and what our subcommittee kind of had in mind when we contemplated this issue, and that is firm-level data. Very much, Richard's report has industry-level data. Industry-level data is not very helpful in terms of a competitive dynamic, but you could very, very easily imagine taking that industry-level data, for example, around firm partner credentials, and dividing it up, right? Having each firm report what those credentials were for their firm as a whole. I think in what I now see as somewhat a naive way, I think that was kind of what we had in mind. One could imagine data, say, on restatements across an entire audit firm. I'm not suggesting necessarily that's what you want to do, but one could imagine that. That's one model. A second model is the model that really looks at these disclosures at an engagement level, which would be you could. And by the way, these models are not necessarily mutually exclusive. They're ways of conceptualizing how you would do this. So that data around an engagement would represent data around an audit firm would disclose to an audit committee and to the investors of that company, staffing levels for that engagement, something more detailed perhaps about fees, qualifications of the partners, that sort of thing. Engagement level disclosure, though, in aggregate across our public companies, turns into firm level disclosure, right? And it's a method by which you can then compare. Which an audit committee or investors could compare one engagement with another within an industry sector and within other types of measures of comparability, such as market cap or measures of complexity. The third possibility is, I think, the possibility really envisioned by the FRC report. And the reason why I say there may be more concepts or structures here is because I didn't think of this one. I'm merely repeating what I've learned from Richard. And so there may be other models that haven't crossed my mind. This model is a model where a lot of the initiative is given to the firms themselves to define what they wish to disclose. But there is intensive interaction between a regulatory body, obviously in this context the PCAOB, and the firms in then shaping that disclosure. Not unlike, in a certain respect, some of the processes that go on under the 34 Act at the SEC. Now, one could mix and match these concepts. And the different types of metrics one could imagine disclosing in relationship to each model are fairly widespread. It's not, they're not infinite, but there's quite a few different possibilities within them. I will leave you with a couple of broad observations about how to think about this. And then I'm going to stop. I think people may be surprised. I'm not going to tell you what the right ones are. I really think that we need to do this collectively. First broad observation is that, as the staff documentation suggests, there is no dependent variable here anyone's been able to define. Say audit quality. What is that? What is that? If we're going to think about this in terms of independent variables and input variables and an output variable, what's the output variable? And rightly, it's been rightly identified that output variable isn't a number. Right? Your audit quality is 7. I mean, that's not how it works. But there's nothing unique about this. Business success, right? Is not definable by one number. There, in fact, is almost nothing of any real interest in life that's definable in that way by one number, maybe height and weight. That doesn't mean, and that was not our intention in forwarding this recommendation, that somehow there's a holy grail out there that Mark and his staff will be able to identify and then force disclosure on. The idea is that there is data that is relevant, right? And that market actors here, coming back to concentration and competition, would want to have access to, and that would improve the general environment in which audit firms operate. So I think I can take the bold step of saying that the committee would reject the notion that because the dependent variable here is kind of a little hard to grab, that we shouldn't be looking for independent variables to have disclosure on. The second observation I'll make is that the committee was very aware, and I hope that in our discussions we are as well, that there is, to use a too often quoted phrase these days, that there can be unintended consequences around disclosure. And in particular that in a world where there's principal-agent problem, in audit selection and management has a principal-agent problem rooted in it, which is that the management of the firm is deeply engaged in it, and their interests, management's interests, and investor interests, and the public interest, and auditor's interests are all a little not entirely aligned with each other. There's also, and so you have to be thoughtful about what it is we want to disclose and the possibility of having the opposite effect that we wish to have. We believe this is why the investor ratification aspect of this is so important. We believe that any thought about the complexities here should take into account the positive impact, we believe, of having the investors involved as a backstop. That should either management or a management or an audit committee wish to sort of go down a road of weakening audit quality, as some people have been known to do, that there is a backstop here that would want that information and that would need that information to catch the backslider. The second point is that the committee was also very aware, because this was the Concentration and Competition Committee, that we have to be concerned about impacts between large firms and smaller firms, and that thoughtfulness needs to be indulged in relation to unforeseen dynamics against the belief that the subcommittee, the full committee, the GAO, and a variety of other people have had, that we ought to be trying to move our audit our markets for auditing services toward a less concentrated state over time, so just as there's a principal agent problem, there's also a concentration issue here that has to be thought about carefully. So with that, I'll just repeat the key observation here, which is that one of the reasons why we did not have specific indicators in our report was because we believe that this group in its totality, the SAG, the board, the staff, actually possesses more information and more wisdom on this than the five or six of us did in our subcommittee. And so it's really a great pleasure to be able to hopefully learn from that. Thank you.
Thank you, Damon, for the additional color in connection with the background behind the recommendation, including the thinking as to why or why not to put in specific indicia of audit quality in the recommendation. We've put in a couple of the questions in the paper that we sent out of the briefing paper for purposes of this general discussion, which we'll have over the next 25 minutes or so. The first was whether a definition of audit quality is a prerequisite for developing meaningful indicators of audit quality, and if so, does anybody have any views on how that should be defined? So while that's the first question, I'd also say, you know, you've heard from Richard, somewhat from me, from Richard and Damon. I'd also say if you have any questions or comments on what you heard from them, please, now's the time to share that. So let's open the floor. And Joe, you're the first with a card up.
Yeah, I have a question for Damon. As it relates to your question up there, Marty, I think there are definitions. None of them are perfect. You've put one up there, and I would agree with Damon's comment that I think there are independent variables that most people could agree are related to audit quality, regardless of how we define it. And trying to come up with a perfect definition, which I don't think we'd ever get, of audit quality shouldn't stop the board from moving forward. But I have a question for Damon. Damon, you laid out three models of audit quality metrics, firm-level data, engagement-level data, and then what you described as the FRC approach, firms decide what to disclose. And so here would be my question. I've read the two letters, I believe, from the same gentleman or lady. We don't even know the gender, I guess, that came to the ACAP. And if I recall correctly, one of the things that motivated this individual's suggestion was that he or she felt that it would the disclosure of these metrics would act as a prod to improve audit quality, which I thought was one of the more persuasive arguments in the letter. And if I recall correctly, this individual suggested that once these metrics were disclosed, whether they're engagement level or firm level, because as you said, you can roll up engagement level to firm level, that your friends in the financial press, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Business Week, and so forth, will have a table with the four or the six or the eight firms on these metrics, just like you do now for universities. And it's amazing how it affects behavior. And the argument is that no managing partner would want to be last for very long. And that would drive major changes in behavior for the good. If you go with the third approach, Damon, you lose that, which I think is something very, at least it seems to me that you lose that, because unless all the firms decide to disclose the same thing, then that benefit's gone. The other thing I would ask you to comment on is you talked about this recommendation came out of the concentration and competition mandate. And if I recall aspects of the report, the argument I believe is made in the report is that some non-Big Four firms may be able to compete quite well on this, which would have the salutary benefit of increasing competition in the profession. But to the extent that, again, it's pick your own metrics, then it's harder for the audit committees and the investing public to compare firms against each other. So the benefit that you're talking about would not be achieved. At least it seems to me would be likely to not be achieved.
So let me start with the simple part of your question and come with a more complex one. It was absolutely our view that this would create a leveler playing field for competition between small and big firms. That the subcommittee felt quite strongly, and I think there's quite a bit of testimony at the hearings that the full committee held, to the effect that one of the barriers to entry to larger cap auditing, right, which is really the concentration and competition problem, is a kind of soft perception that the four largest firms are the only responsible choices, right? And without getting into expressing a preference among firms, I would say that having disclosures of some hard data across all firms would present an opportunity for smaller firms to make a case, right? Assuming that they had it. Now, secondly, I think that your point about which again is taken, I think, from the letters that we received and was the committee's view that, you know, what is measured is managed, right? That we felt that if you had the right metrics disclosed, that they would definitely be managed to. Right? And that although there are issues about just the sort of the size of the audit market, particularly for large cap firms, and exactly how that would play out, but the feeling would be that those things would be managed to, and those numbers would both improve and that firms would all be trying to avoid, as you say, being at the bottom. Now, that's a double-edged sword, though. I mean, I think we need to acknowledge. And, if you pick the wrong thing to manage to, like, you know, gross mortgage originations, for example, the outcome may not be what you want, right? And I think that feeling was part of why we deferred on picking, right? Now, as to the question of whether you'd have a different outcome from the FRC-type model, I'm going to ask Richard to comment for a moment, although you didn't address the question to him. I'll say this. I think from what I understand of the FRC model, one might, depending on the sort of culture that one operates in and the desires and capacity of the regulator, and I think one of the, there are differences in national regulatory style, right? One could imagine a similar kind of roll-up thing coming out of the FRC model, but it would require a great deal of pretty aggressive involvement by the regulator, right, in shaping what those disclosures look like. And it would also depend on a certain amount of genuine, a pretty intense genuine competitive dynamic among the firms so that, I run my firm, I choose to disclose a certain set of metrics, then the other firms feel compelled to disclose the same. Right? I think that these are tactics to achieving the same goal. We in the United States have a long heritage of being somewhat skeptical on the regulatory front, at least outside maybe of certain, maybe outside maybe of banking, we'll see where that got us, really not relying upon those kinds of informal measures to force the disclosure, but rather, having the regulator draw the table and then you fill in the numbers or action is taken. I think that the committee envisioned something of that nature. Right? When we envisioned this, we envisioned a kind of sort of simple notion that there's some metrics and then you have to disclose what those metrics are and everyone does the same. Right? Now, I think the regulatory style in the United Kingdom is different. And I think it has implications and it has roots in different market environments and a variety of different things. I'm going to leave it at that and ask Richard to fill in.
Thank you, Damon. I'll be brief because in some senses one of the key points has already been raised by Damon. But let me just try and draw out one point which we certainly do have in mind. And I'm interested that the proposal comes from the Competition and Choice Competition and Concentration Group, because actually one of the things we wanted to see happen, and hope to see happen, I should say, is that we wanted to see how firms tried to differentiate themselves and demonstrate that they really were delivering audit quality. Let me just give you two types of ways in which that might happen. There is certainly the case that one firm in the UK has a policy of focusing on the quality of the intake of the people that it takes into the firm from the outset. To take the, if I can put it this way, the Wall Street law firm model, they only take 5% from Harvard, Yale, New York, and Cornell, or wherever it happens to be, and one of their ways of measuring or demonstrating the quality of their work is to talk to the quality of the people that make up their staff. Another firm would probably argue that it has exceptionally good systems for bringing an audit to a conclusion with a process by which the audit issues are discussed, more people with experience are brought in to contribute to that, so that you get an opinion which has a real weight of experience in it, and so forth. Now, there are two different ways of trying to demonstrate to the market that you do something better than somebody else. And one of the things we wanted to do was, in the context of competition and choice, was to try and also encourage people to think about how they could differentiate themselves in a market which, frankly, is dominated by four firms that are perhaps practically indistinguishable to the average member of the public, or the investment community for that matter. And so I think you need to see what the FRC was proposing in that context. You also need to, if I may say so, see it in the context where, going back to your comment about actual metrics and people having to do it, you know, we have a corporate governance regime which has been in place now for nearly 20 years, which I don't think is disregarded by many. Well, it's not disregarded in the UK, and it's reasonably well respected internationally, and yet it is a comply and explain model with absolutely no regime to enforce it whatsoever. But the investment community and the business community recognize that to depart from that is a decision of huge consequence. So I think you have to look at the FRC model in the context of what we were trying to achieve, and also in the environment where people, frankly, had better comply or and step up to the plate, or, as I've tried to indicate, we will take it to another level. Does that help a little bit?
I think we have another question or comment from Chuck Noski.
Thank you. I guess my question is for Damon as well. You know, I am concerned, and I know we'll get into this in the breakout groups, I am concerned about what quantitative measures get disclosed publicly, because I do agree that if they're measured, we will drive behavior and firms will optimize to those numbers, and I do worry about the unintended consequences of optimizing to numbers that may not necessarily be good predictors of audit quality or audit failure, so I think we need to be thoughtful about that. As the chair of two audit committees, I do agree that there is an information void in terms of what we get in order to make judgments about the performance of the firms. And so there is some information that I think perhaps not publicly disclosed but routinely required to be reviewed by all audit committees would be appropriate. So I think we need to think about also public versus private disclosure and the information around there. But there's probably some level of public information that would be useful to everybody, and I think would be useful to investors as they consider their ratification decision. So I'm comfortable with that. I know one of the things we do use in my audit committees to talk about quality is the report from the PCAOB's examination, and we review that the part one of the document and to the extent that the PCAOB staff has identified accounting or auditing issues unique to a particular industry that might be the industry that our company is in, we really spend a lot of time probing the audit firm on whether or not that condition has any implications to our audit of our company. And I think that's useful. We also have been successful in extracting the content of the Part two, the private section from the audit firms, not necessarily in the level of detail I might like, but we do get a sense of it. I guess the question for Damon is, in your committee, did you give much consideration to what the role of the PCAOB's examination process might be in both the disclosure and the evaluation? Because what I worry about with the quantitative measures, we're talking about measuring quality with quantitative measures, and I am sort of from Missouri on that. And 20 years ago, when I was spending a lot of time in industry, we talked about the cost of quality and measuring the cost of quality in manufacturing and service businesses, and it was really, really hard. It was inconclusive in many cases. I will tell you the amount of time and money we devoted to trying to figure it out was substantial, and I think we got better. But it may not get to the level, it may not necessarily achieve the objective that I think your committee would be encouraging the PCAOB to achieve. So be interested in your thoughts there.
Well, I think your comments are, I think, in line with certainly the thinking that led to this recommendation. In terms of the specific question, The committee thought that there was obviously, we believed, a great deal of knowledge resident here at the PCAOB and in the staff here. Some of it embodied in the part twos, and some of it perhaps not even written down. And that we wanted to see that knowledge deployed to help select the metrics. That's a critical element of our view, that we were not going to tell the PCAOB what the metrics should be. We felt that they had the PCAOB has the information advantage. We did not think that the potential that some, or the reality that some audit committees are able to extract some of that information, as you have been, was widespread enough to be or complete enough, as I think you indicated, to be a substitute for what we were considering. However, I don't think our view was that these types of disclosures of particular metrics would in any sense be sufficient in and of themselves to guide a decision maker. Right? We view them as supplementing the sorts of processes that you were describing that you go through already, in a context in which your observation about an information vacuum appears to be really surprisingly widespread among audit committees. As the only investor rep on the subcommittee, I learned a lot in a number of ways from the conversations we had about the difficulties of being on an audit committee in relationship to information by people who were clearly committed to that task on behalf of their firm and their investors, but yet felt underpowered. One would think that people in that position, who are the customer, after all, of the audit services and have the ability to withhold the contract, could get the information they need. It doesn't seem to be the case. The hard part is figuring out what is the right supplemental information. I am completely convinced that there is a body of data that it would be useful to have out there. I'm also convinced that you have to be thoughtful about what it is, because it will be managed to. Whatever we set out there, people will focus on it in the firms, not just in the firms, on the audit committees, among investors, and in the financial press. But I don't think that that's an argument for not doing it.
I know there are a few more cards up, and we'll get to those in a second. We posed a second question in the paper, but it's been touched on by both Damon and Richard, and that is whether audit quality indicators and effectiveness are really more feasible and more meaningful at either an individual audit engagement level or the auditing firm level as a whole, or maybe both. And you've talked about that a bit, but I just wanted to make sure you knew that question was being posed to this group also, or could be considered in the breakouts. Greg, Jonas, I think you had your card up.
Well, let me address the previous question, Marty, that you had up there, which I think is should we go through the burdensome process of defining audit quality as a prerequisite to coming up with measures? First, I commend the Treasury Committee for teeing this whole issue up. I think this is very important, and it offers a chance to really help improve things. And so I'm a big fan of taking the time to do this. It strikes me that if the theory here is you manage what you measure, and we're all about coming up with measures, then you got to know where we're trying to take this thing. So I don't know how one can avoid deciding quite specifically what the heck we're trying to do. What is audit quality? I don't know how we avoid that. Otherwise, if you don't know where you're going, any road gets you there. So maybe it's stupid me. I didn't think it was all that hard. Because we know what the outputs of the audit process are. There are four of them. And we need to state what the quality objective is for each. And I think we got a vision of quality then, and then we go on to talk about how to measure it. No doubt I'm simplifying this greatly. But I thought I've done it. And I think giving thought to it, as a group here, I think we should take the time to do that.
Thanks, Greg. Tom Linsmeyer.
Responding to your first question, not as an FASB board member, but more as a former academic. I don't know how you could possibly avoid, if you're going to do this well, like Greg, I think you absolutely have to define a measure of audit quality. Because absent that measure, any independent variable that is reported as an indicator is a whim. You don't know whether it is really distinguishes the quality or not. Is it a discriminating variable? Is it something that's correlated with something that matters or doesn't? What are the key factors that really drive audit quality? And without defining audit quality, I don't know that you can remotely come up with anything to report that would be meaningful and not have a great deal of unintended consequences. I think voluntarily letting the firms come up with measures to distinguish themselves, they will find ways to distinguish themselves in those numbers, but I don't know that there will be anything meaningful in the numbers that they come forward with. So I agree with Joe's comments. I think there has to be some sort of required reporting that's common across the firms to have this be meaningful at all. But to move forward, I think it's absolutely imperative to come up with some sort of judgment as to what quality is. And I think you're actually asking the right group, but we are at a hugely comparative disadvantage to the PCAOB. The PCAOB is running an inspection program. There must be something underlying that inspection program that's driving your view of what you inspect, what you pay attention to be able to assess what quality is or not in that inspection program. And then once you have that information, what is your distinguishing characteristics, you also have access to data that no one else has. And so I find it a disadvantage to start with looking at all academic research or looking at what the GAO has said previously, because those particular studies have been constrained by publicly available information that is a subset of what the PCAOB has access to. And so in some respects, I think the conversation would be better informed if the PCAOB would come forward with some thought processes as to what they're thinking about in terms of quality, both strengths and weaknesses of the measures they're looking at, because it's clearly a multiple attribute measure. I don't think it's only one. Greg thinks there's four. I suspect if we started talking, it would explode quickly beyond four in trying to come up with it. But I don't know that getting reactions from us, given your comparative advantage, is exactly the right starting point. I think the better starting point is to understand what you've understood and revealed in your inspection process, put forward some quality measures, and then think about what might be the independent variables tied to quality and actually run some statistical analysis to see what's discriminatory in being able to identify that. All of that might work just internally. The next question is there any value to disclosing those externally? If those measures of correlation are really rather weak, I don't know that they're rather discriminatory and sufficient to be disclosed publicly. Some observations.
Thanks, Tom. Lynn Turner?
I'd just like to echo what Greg said. People already manage a lot by the numbers. I don't know why people are worried about putting numbers out there. People manage to. Each of the firms managed numbers anyway. They manage to a budget number for revenue each year, labor cost as a percent of revenues, partner contributions, rate per hour, number of billable hours that each partner is responsible for. They already got those out there, and they're always already managing to them. So the fact that someone would say, well, let's actually manage something that relates to audit quality only seems to be common sense and not rocket scientist. Tom's probably right. I think you probably ought to come up with some definition of audit quality, but I wouldn't turn this into a rocket scientist exercise. I think it's very simple. Are the numbers accurate at the end of the day? Do they come to me accurate as an investor? And two, are their communications to investors and the audit committees complete and timely and robust enough? And I think the last part is very important, as is the first part. So I think this is very doable. I think it's got to be specific, definable things. And I think it's good that people actually manage the quality.
Marty, can I get just a word here, unless there's other people waiting?
Please do.
I want to, in light of the past group of comments, I want to make it emphasize a couple of things I said in passing earlier. The first is that the three models of how to do this that I've set forward are not mutually exclusive, right? If you know, and I think that's important, right? The second is that put some precision on this issue of defining audit quality. It's clearly possible to write a narrative description of audit quality. I don't know whether it's a four-point description, as Greg suggests, I'm sure I've seen one that's one sentence in relation to the accuracy of financial statements. You can obviously make a much longer one, and the longer you get, the more nuanced and so forth. I think having that in mind, having some narrative description of what it is we're trying to achieve is probably not a bad idea at all. But I think that trying to reduce that to a regression analysis, which is why I talked about very dependent and independent variables, making a valid regression analysis the prerequisite of action here is going to be a recipe for doing nothing, because it's not possible, I believe, to take that narrative description, which you can construct, and turn it into a number. Right? That's why when I talk about the number 7. Right, it's just you can't go from one to the other, and therefore you can't go, and therefore you can't make that type of analysis and the types of regressions that you would then run to determine what's a meaningful contributing variable. It's a recipe for a dead end, right? And if I don't think there's anything particularly unique about audit quality in that respect. I think that is a set of circumstances analytically that exists in a lot of other places in our economy and our society, where, as Lynn puts it, numbers are nonetheless disclosed and managed to. And so I would hope that while the board is focused, right, on having some concept of audit quality that we are trying to get to, that we not put these, I think, inappropriate analytic prerequisites in front of us before acting, certainly I think that would be the committee's wish.
Thanks, Damon. We are about at the end of this session. We're going to take a short break till around 3:30 or so. On the board right here are the breakout groups, Group A, B, and C. Bella, does everybody have these sheets elsewhere? I'm going to turn this over to Bella in one second. Group A, we're asking to consider the questions that are in the briefing paper from a perspective of investors' needs. What's the feasibility of audit quality indicators, and what's the need from an investor's point of view for audit quality indicators and measures? From Group B, from an issuer's point of view, what does an audit committee have, need, want, with respect to audit quality indicators, and try to come at the question from that point of view. And from Group C, from an auditor's point of view, what would auditors think about the audit quality indicators and unintended consequences, which comes up often in terms of discussion here, and also the usefulness of such indicators in their view. So. That's what we're asking you to do. It's the first time we've gone through breakout sessions in the group, and we're looking forward to those meetings. Tomorrow morning we'll come back here in the chairs of each of those breakout sessions. We'll take about 15 minutes each to kind of summarize the thoughts of their breakout group, and then we'll have another half-hour discussion to kind of wrap this topic up. Bella, did you want to add anything further?
For those individuals that will be participating in the breakout group discussions, the breakout group discussions are going to take place upstairs, so directly above us. There's also refreshments and more snacks up there, so you don't have to try to balance everything as you're going upstairs. And please let me know if you have any questions. And as Marty said, for those that are not going to be participating in the breakout sessions, there will be a summary tomorrow morning starting at 9 a.m. And this concludes this portion of the meeting. Thank you.